I am just trolling.
From Yahoo Sports, this is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast.
Hey, get out of here.
That's what you're calling.
Sean is right.
The FC Yahoo Podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the FC Yahoo Podcast. I am your host, Shahan Ahmed, coming to you from Playa Vista here in the Wayne Gretzky room today. With me today on the podcast is Joey Galino.
Like I said before, a great room for hopefully a great podcast. I think I'm inspired right now.
Also, Alex Baker.
I am growing out a mullet as we speak to celebrate being in the Gretzky room.
Is that what that is? Okay. Yeah.
So we're about to head out to the international break coming up. But before we do that, we're going to touch on what's been going on in Europe and also start with the Premier League. Now, this weekend was eventful, but just an overall summary, we've gone through three rounds in England, and Manchester United is top of the table, the only unbeaten team in England, and in second place is actually Liverpool, after they did a 4-0 job on Arsenal. And yes, we are going to dedicate a fair amount of time now to Arsenal. It was one of those really, really embarrassing performances. And then today ended up being the six-year anniversary of that 8-2 game, which we referenced, I think, last week or the week before. So as a reminder to everybody, and the funny thing was actually, Manchester United put up the highlights from that 8-2 game today to celebrate. As a reminder to all Arsenal fans that, hey, it's bad, but you guys have kind of been here for a while. There have been embarrassments along the way. Alex, let's start with you. Was yesterday's, or was the 4-0 worse than the 8-2?
Yeah, I think it was because, you know, the 8-2 came at a time when the team was depleted. We'd been selling players. We hadn't really been adequately replacing them. And I actually think that season when Wenger somehow got that team into the top four is actually almost his last greatest accomplishment as a manager, because that was such an average, mediocre team. Sure, they got pounded by United, but, you know, look at the squad we put out yesterday and look at the players we have available to us. You've made good signings. You've got Alexander Lacazette. He starts on the bench. You know, said Kolasinac is working out. And yet we're still finding a way to be as terrible, or if not worse, than we were when we had Squillaci and Marouan Chamakh.
Yeah, well, to go back to that team, it was one of those rare occurrences where Arsenal's defense was just depleted that day. I remember, I believe Carl Jenkinson had his Premier League debut. We had, you know, Coquelin coming into the squad. I think Johan Giroud started in the middle of the defense.
Wasn't Emmanuel Frimpong in that?
I think he was on the bench. Yeah. And I think Chamakh was on the bench. And I think Walcott got the start. In any case, that was a whole different team, and they were under some adverse circumstances because they were dealing with injuries. This was Alexis Sanchez starting, Mesut Ozil starting. This was, Koscielny was back as well. There weren't really any excuses.
You had the two starting strikers for the French national team, both on the bench, yeah. And you can't get a shot on goal.
Well, let's recap this before I throw it to you, Joey. So the game started, and Mohamed Salah almost scored. He almost scored in the 10th minute,
yeah.
And Petr Cech made a heck of a save. It was the 17th minute when Firmino gets that header. And for Firmino, it's actually 4 goals in 5 appearances against Arsenal, so it's kind of turning into his Drogba team, if you will. And then Xhaka tried to play this idiotic chip. All he had to do was play a very simple pass to Alexis Sanchez.
There's no words for that chip.
Yeah, and you know, Mane, curling finish. And
great finish.
Credit to Mane, but that was an awful turnover from a guy that's, let's just be honest, okay? Xhaka has not been good. At Arsenal, he has just not lived up to it at all, and it's seemingly every week is worse. But then we had a few breakaways with Salah, and you know, he ends up eventually getting a tidy finish for a 3-0 in the second half. And then Sturridge comes in, and at the back post, you know, it was the reminder of, hey, Sturridge is still on the team? Everybody, it's like, oh, yeah, he is.
He's a nice buzz cut, too, apparently.
Because, yeah, he looked real clean cut because he's just scored a goal. But in the aftermath of that match, we had, you know, a few quotes coming out, and Wenger said, quote, "We were beaten everywhere physically," was the quote that stood out to me. And then, you know, he said, "Of course it was shocking, but I believe just our performance on the day was absolutely disastrous." Now, Arsenal have lost 2 away games. They had no shots on goal this game. Lee Dixon, who's a former fullback for Arsenal, said it was the worst Arsenal performance he's seen since he's retired. Thierry Henry, the club legend, called it unwatchable. His quote was, "It's painful. It's how they lose. It's always the same. You have seen it before. Everything you see reminds you of what has happened for the last 10 years." And now Sky Sports Today is reporting that Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain is being sold, a fee has been agreed for his move to Chelsea. So, given everything that we've seen now, Joey, what do you make of Arsenal currently going forward? Is it just as simple as this is it? Get rid of Wenger over this international break. Find anybody. Doesn't matter. What is the next step to fixing Arsenal?
I think there's so many things about yesterday that we can dissect, and I do want to agree that this is worse than the 8-2. And I think the main problem here is when that 8-2 happened. You know, you guys kind of mentioned it a little bit. That was back when Wenger was still using the stadium debt as an excuse for not buying players. The squad was really, really sad and really, really just not capable of producing very much quality. And while it's not okay for that to happen to Arsenal, at least, you know, there was a clear solution. It's like, hey, Wenger, start buying some more players, you know. And let's be honest, that United side was the class of the league at the time. That was the Sir Alex side kind of humming on all cylinders. This was different because Liverpool is really good. And I think, you know, they clearly looked like a top four favorite, if maybe an outside title contender. But they're not the class that Manchester United was back in those days. And to go back to the first point, these are all players that you've bought for major money, including Xhaka, including Alexis Sanchez, including Mesut Ozil, and they're just not producing for whatever reason. Now, Sanchez may be a little unfair because this was his first game, I think, since the Confederations Cup, so he was understandably off the pace. But granted, Xhaka is so bad. I tweeted that I don't understand how he gets games for anybody in the top five European leagues, let alone a team that purportedly has designs on making the Champions League. And I think that central midfield where you have Ramsey being reckless going forward and not, you know, instructing Ozil to drop off and receive some of his passes in the midfield, whatever there was a communication breakdown there. Again, Xhaka is just, I don't know what he's good at. He's not a good passer. He doesn't make good runs in the space. He is kind of lazy tracking back every now and then. I guess he's a good free kick taker, but if that's your only hallmark, then you got big problems. Where's Lacazette? Why is he not starting? Why would you go with Danny Welbeck, who coincidentally was part of the United side in that 8-2 destruction
a few years ago?
Yeah, and you know, it's the thing is, I think it's not as simple as getting rid of Wenger, but I think it is in some ways. Because there's going to be no room for a rebuild. There's going to be no space to come in and overhaul this where there's clearly problems here. Clearly problems. Like, tactically yesterday, there was, trotting out the three in the back. It's kind of like Liverpool is going to try to spread you out. They're going to have that heavy metal football, the gegenpressing, all that. And that's going to be something that they have to work for to get those spaces if you play a back four, say, for example, or you have a more defensive-minded lineup. But when you go three in the back to begin with, Liverpool doesn't have to do any work. They were absolutely brilliant going forward yesterday. And, you know, we mentioned, you know, the Sadio Mane was great when he took that touch. I think Rob Holding kind of misplayed it a little too. You want to put him on his left foot, and Holding gave him space to go to the right and curl that nice finish. But That's what these guys are going to do to you. And the fact that Wenger wasn't pragmatic in the setup is a huge, huge problem. And, you know, when I say that it's not that simple as getting rid of Wenger, it's kind of like you alluded to, Sean. It's like, well, who do you really bring in? There's not exactly a Jurgen Klopp, for example, just kind of waiting on the sidelines, unless you think you can get Tom Tuchel or somebody like that. But, it's clear that the first step probably just has to be finally cutting bait with Arsene Wenger and being like, you know what? You have meant a lot to this club, but you ruined your chance to go out on your own terms. And the board's got to say it. The board's got to do it. I just don't think they have the spine.
Yeah, it's getting worse under Arsene Wenger. It's not improving. And he's actually started to spend money. And that was the thing before, was that they weren't spending money, and it was frustrating. And we were kind of treading water. You know, I remember being excited when they signed Granit Xhaka. I'd seen a little bit of him with Borussia Mönchengladbach, and everything you read about him sounded like he was going to be that guy. He's not been. you know, Mesut Ozil doesn't seem like any kind of world beater out there.
He drifts too much. He's great at times, and then he's just absolutely non-existent.
Yeah, so, and you have to say, when you get down to it, it's the manager. This is a decent enough squad. I'm not saying they're going to go to Anfield and get a win over Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool right now, but there's a really good piece in The Guardian today. I'll give a plug to Amy Lawrence. And one of the things she said that, In the last 5 years, there's been 20 results of this magnitude of Arsenal just getting thrashed. And some of them are obvious, the 8-2, the 10-2 aggregate against Bayern last season. And, you know, this is a good enough team to not get blown out by teams that they should be competing with for the most part. Some of these players, I don't know if Rob Holding is really up to this level. He was in Mane's pocket for most of the first half. But I think, you know, if the players aren't ready and they're not up to it, as Wenger says, then he has to look in the mirror as far as why. He's the guy who's supposed to be getting them ready.
You know, that I think that's the thing. The preparation is the issue. After the match, Jurgen Klopp on the U.S. broadcast actually came and talked to the announcers. And they were asking him about, you know, tactically, did you know what Arsenal was going to do? And he pretty much was like, yeah, I mean, we know what we're going to do.
Exactly.
Like, it was not even, and he tried to say, you know, what most managers will say in terms of, well, we were just worried about ourselves and the way we play. But when you really take a step back and think about it, if Arsenal had Jurgen Klopp, would they be a better team? And I think unquestionably right now, just about everyone would say, yeah, they would be on a week-to-week basis more competitive. They'd be more up for the big matches. They would be better, more adept to actually game planning for their opponents. Because right now, they just it seems like, hey, we changed to three in the back. That's the big change we're going to make, and we've made this adjustment. We're with the times. It's like, no, you're really not, because you're not looking at the matches game by game. And the only plan B you end up having is going back to that plan A that wasn't working in the first place, which is why you switched to three in the back to catch up with what everybody had already been doing. It's one of those situations where I feel like, and this is, you know, it's a broken record. We've been saying this for years, but it's one of those situations where you just need new blood, whatever that new blood is. It doesn't even matter if it works initially. I mean, look at Manchester United. It took them three tries until they finally got a guy that looks like it's working out. But if they had just stuck with Sir Alex, let's say he just went through a decline the last, you know, 3-4 years that United had after he left, it would have been very painful and difficult to move to that next era of United. And Arsenal has been unable to move to the next era because Arsene's still there.
Yeah, they're long overdue for moving to that era. And you have to ask yourself, what is Arsenal gaining from Arsene Wenger at all? You know, a few years ago, people used to criticize Arsenal and say, oh, well, they play very pretty attractive football, but they don't get results. Do they play pretty attractive football anymore? They just look a mess to me. They just look a mess. And I've said this before on the pod that it's sad because 3 or 4, maybe 5 years ago, Wenger could have walked into the Barcelona job. He could have left and gone to Real Madrid or PSG.
PSG, yeah.
What club would want Arsene Wenger? What top-level club would want Arsene Wenger as their manager right now?
Yeah.
Not very many, I would say, are standing in line to sign him.
I agree. And I think his quotes actually yesterday directly to the reporter on the NBC broadcast seemed to me to signal a bit of a shift in tone. There wasn't the rampant blaming of everybody else. There wasn't kind of saying, oh, the ref, we were hard done by the ref, or we have a lot of injuries, or, you know, they played dirty. Like, he always, one thing that drives us all nuts is, like, he would always say that it was someone else's fault instead of theirs. But yesterday he said, no, you know what, this was all on us. Like, we gave a really poor account of ourselves. And if that realization is finally coming to him, then he, better than anybody, should know, you know, to kind of build off the Sir Alex point, like, they did battle for a number of years. Arsenal was the chief competitor to United in the league for a number of years. And United had kind of two very defined iterations under Sir Alex. They had the, at least in the Premier League era, they had the class of 92 and the core from that team. And then once that core started aging out or being sold off, then all of a sudden, you have to go out and get new players. And who do they get? They get the core of Rio Ferdinand from Leeds and Wayne Rooney from Everton and Cristiano Ronaldo. They get him for the first six, seven years before he gets sold to Real Madrid. And then you get that second kind of – you get the core for that second team going forward. Wenger never got a second core after that great turn-of-the-century team on into the mid-aughts that he had. He just kind of – it got worse, and now it's clear that he can't do things the way that the modern economics of the game require you to do in terms of building a true title contender. So if that realization is dawning on him based on what we saw yesterday after the match, then I think it's for the best. I'm just not sure that's going to be the case.
I don't know if that's exactly true, Joey. I feel like the 2008-2009 team had enough talent to really put on a serious title. You know, you had Robin Van Persie, you had Cesc Fabregas, Samir Nasri. That was a pretty good team. Gael Clichy.
Pretty good.
They still, all those guys went on to win major titles at other teams and yeah. to be important parts of those teams.
So. But I also think there's a reason they didn't stick around entirely. I mean, I don't know. You know, it just, I think it's been kind of easy for other people to spot the decline of the club and not Wenger so much himself because he's right there amid it.
I mean, for me, the same criticism has been launched at Arsenal even after they bought. And it's that Xhaka position. It's that central holding midfielder. The real central focus of what makes the back and the attack meet in the middle. And they just don't have a guy that you would say is a top five guy there or a top 10 guy there either.
Why can't they find
Well, that's the thing. It's like, they, you know, he tried to put Coquelin in that role and develop him, but when he took way too long to develop and put a guy in there, you know, Ramsey's not really that guy, but no, he ends up playing in that type of role. Santi Cazorla fit into that role for a little bit for them, and you know, it was in tandem with Coquelin, but still, they've never actually gotten, you know, last year we were all saying, why didn't Arsenal get involved with Conte? Because Conte would be the perfect guy for that.
Great.
But didn't they scout him at one point and say he wasn't talented enough?
I mean, whatever the reasoning, Arsenal has just not been able to fill that one major gap because they've spent money in the back, they've spent money up front, they have talent around the pitch, they have talent on the wings. Well, less now that Ox is probably gone, but they have talent around in their squad, but that central position, which is so important, they just have never quite figured it out. But you know what? We're going to move on to the rest of the Premier League. Just do a quick recap. And you know, Chelsea, Everton had a pretty eventful game. Chelsea looked really good. Alvaro Morata looked fantastic. Had a goal, had an assist, I believe. Fabregas actually looked really good early as well. He's the one who combined with Morata on the early goal.
Mm-hmm.
So for all those crazy rumors of Conte being out, it seems like he's not really about to go anywhere unless Roman does what Roman does. Also, we had Spurs, who have now dropped 5 points at home compared to 4 points all of last season at home. So the Wembley curse is definitely continuing for Spurs.
It is a thing.
It's not going anywhere, and they're not going anywhere. So, I mean, that's not going to be good for them domestically or in Europe, seems like. We had Peter Crouch score a goal. That's always eventful. Tony Pulis did
robot dance.
Yeah.
Robot dance.
Well, he came on as a substitute, and the ball just, it was awful defending. Just fell to him, and he headed it in, didn't. You know, happy Crouch, everybody loves that. Tony Pulis didn't win for a change, so, you know, I'm sure Henry Bushnell is happy somewhere. Man City had a controversial win, but, you know, Charlie Daniels in that match had an incredible strike. Incredible strike. Top right corner outside the box. Just
gorgeous.
Yeah, it was amazing. Gabriel Jesus finally got on the board. You know, Mendy started, the most expensive fullback in the world. Or most expensive defender, period, in the world. And, you know, Bournemouth really were hard done because there was a 97th minute Raheem Sterling goal, which led to a little bit of mayhem in the crowd, some accusations, which were just completely idiotic, where the steward said that Aguero attacked him when he clearly did not.
Not at all. The steward
was the one pushing him. Ends up, Raheem Sterling gets a second yellow card on that and gets sent off, where he didn't actually go in the crowd. The crowd came on the pitch. That's on the security to keep them off. I'm not sure what exactly, you know, the match referee was thinking there. But again, you know, we were talking about it. I was talking about it last week. But Sterling's been good for Man City. And he got the start this time. And he got a 97th minute match winner for them. So, you know, credit to City. They're not, you know, United's still the only perfect squad. But that's, you know, anything you guys want to add from the first three rounds of the Premier League?
I still think the City result, even with the theatrics at the end, I think you can make a convincing argument that there was, the 97th minute winner, there was nothing wrong with it because the added time, in addition to the time that was wasted during stoppage time, it wasn't the most outlandish extension of the game for me in the world. And I think that the fact that they won that game, again, I kind of go back to what I said about City in week one against Brighton and Hove Albion. You know, these are games. Ask Liverpool how they would like to fare in these games against, like, the non-top six sides. You know, these are the kind of points that you have to pick up if you want to keep pace. Like, if they would have dropped points, if they would have tied this match, then all of a sudden you're looking at being, what, 4 points behind Man United already at this early stage? So I think City is actually showing some pretty good qualities. The Everton tie last week was a little weird. I think you're right with Sterling starting. He's giving them a spark for whatever it is, and so it was very smart of Pep to put him back in there. It's kind of up to managers to recognize these things as the season goes on, and that's why I think it just bodes well for them going forward. United, you know, you really can't say enough about them. They've been fantastic. We've covered that space enough, so there's no really big need to dwell on that until they get their first test probably at Anfield in October. But I think, you know, the two Manchester clubs are good. Chelsea seems to have righted the ship. And can we trademark the Spurs Wembley curse? Has that actually been, like, something that someone else has trademarked, or can we get on that?
I think we should just name the podcast the Wembley Curse.
The Wembley Curse? Oh, that's not bad.
Well, before I ask you the same question, Alex, I just, you know, one note that I had that I didn't share was I was watching Match of the Day, too, and it was the Everton-Chelsea match, and I heard John Champion say at the 50-minute mark that it was the first time an Everton player had touched the ball in Chelsea's box. Chelsea was that dominant. It was 5 minutes in the second half, and it was the first time there was an attempt. It was Rooney, I think, put in. I forget who it was, but it was just an awful take. I think it was Sandro, and he just an awful shot. And John Jamie goes, that is the first time Everton has had the ball in Chelsea's box.
Wow.
Yeah, I think the rumors of Chelsea's downfall were greatly exaggerated, and I think that we're going to see them up in the mix with the two Manchester sides as far as the title. I'm not quite ready to call Liverpool a title contender, but I certainly think I underestimated their ability to finish top four, which they look pretty bang on to do right now.
Without Coutinho, we should say.
I think, yeah, Coutinho-less Liverpool had no problem yesterday. Take the money and run, Jurgen Klopp. That's what I would say. City, you know, they're getting the results, but they're still laboring a little bit. But they are getting the results. So at a certain point, they're going to click, and then they're going to be really scary, I think. But can we talk about West Ham for a minute? What's going on with Slaven Bilic?
As a Slaven Bilic stan, I would rather not, but yeah,
I know.
Right.
We all are Bilic fans.
I know. Think every football... Wait a second.
Okay.
We are not all
Bilic
fans.
Okay, everyone but Shahan. But he's an easy manager to like as a neutral, and you got to say West Ham have arguably the most improved squad.
They made
smart purchases around the field.
Yeah.
Why are they so bad? What's going on?
Those players are too good to be performing like this, to have no points through. Yeah, and yeah, you could say they were kind of screwed at Southampton last week, but it's just these guys are not giving a proper account of themselves. I don't care if their first game was at Old Trafford. I don't care what the circumstances have been. You know, this question came up last year, and I thought it was blasphemous to think that Slaven Bilic is not the right guy for this job, but that's after a certain point, the results are what they are, you know? And this is way too good of a team, again, to be in this position, so.
Along with Bournemouth, one of the other teams, there's
no
three
points.
Teams at the bottom with no points.
Yeah.
And Newcastle, who came in with no points, just did a number on them.
Mm-hmm. By the way, Huddersfield have given up no goals.
Yeah. they're tied for second.
That's zero that they got on their score sheet, or their clean sheet, I should say, is round and clear as the head of Patrick Stewart, their famous fan. Sir Patrick Stewart, I should say.
Well, we'll just, you know what? I think we're done Premier League talk for now, and let's come back, take a quick peek around Europe, and then we'll get into the international World Cup qualifiers. We'll be back.
This podcast is brought to you by Fine Corinthian Leather.
And we are back. Okay, so now let's take a quick peek around Europe. And I think it makes sense to start in La Liga, where Real Madrid actually had an entertaining draw with Valencia on Sunday. And this one was awesome. The second half was incredible. The last 15 minutes stoppage time. It was one of those matches where Gareth Bale and Karim Benzema looked pretty awful. They missed a fair amount of chances. Marco Asensio, the man of the moment, is just on fire. He had two goals, including the equalizer off a free kick, but his first goal was just tremendous. Cut it on his left foot from outside the box and just shaped the ball perfectly into the net. Credit to Valencia, although, man, Simone Zaza should have had a couple chances. Gareth Bale missed a point-blank header and immediately got substituted after that, so that goes to show you that it's not necessarily going all great. Valencia actually had the lead, you know, pretty late on. They looked like they could have pulled the complete upset. So at the moment, Barcelona is top and Real Madrid is not, which is interesting, right? It's not really how we expected it. Actually, no, they're not top. Real Sociedad is technically top on goal differential, which everybody called, let's be honest. But it's only been two rounds, and Barcelona is now just now getting in Dembele over from Dortmund, which should be a great pickup. He's picking up the number 11 jersey, which was vacated by Neymar, and looks to be a like-for-like replacement. So even if Coutinho doesn't come, they've added Paulinho and Dembele, and everybody seems extremely excited about this kid coming in. What do you make of how do you think Dembele is going to impact Barcelona, Joey?
Well, I think it gives them, you know, another that third attacker to kind of, since you're able to move Messi around pretty freely, and since Dembele has, you know, experience playing in Borussia Dortmund, which has got some of the best young attacking talent in Europe, I think there's a lot of different ways that they can play him there. Is he Neymar? No. But he's really, really good, and his best years are clearly in front of him. I think he might have 3 or 4 years before he even hits his prime. And if you can convince him to stay and kind of be this – not only is he – because of that youth, it's not only that you're getting a great attacking player that can fit with the guys that they have there now – it's you're getting that guy who could maybe be what Neymar would have been, because we talked about when the Neymar transfer saga was going on how Messi is getting older. Suarez, I think, is about to turn 30. You know, these guys still have a lot in the tank, but they're also not getting any younger. They're on kind of the wrong side of their careers. And Dembele is a guy who is – he's got all the world in front of him, and he seems very enthusiastic about joining Barcelona. And I think that is also a key. As silly as it sounds to say, Neymar clearly wasn't infatuated with the idea, the mythos of Barcelona and carrying that torch into the future. And it seems like Dembele is. So while you don't get a like-for-like replacement in Neymar or in Dembele for Neymar, you do get kind of an approximation of what you were hoping Neymar would be. And I think at this point in the transfer window, after Barcelona was clearly staggered by his departure in a lot of different ways, this is really good for them. I think this is something that really kind of puts them maybe not on level with Real Madrid at the current moment, but they're clearly, you know, we asked the question, will Atletico Madrid finish second above Barcelona? We were even saying if they lose Messi, will they make the Champions League? Well, now I think you pretty much guarantee that not only will they make the Champions League, they are a team that can legitimately compete for La Liga again.
So before Dembele came in, Messi scored twice this weekend, which were his 351st La Liga goals. Not bad for a guy who's 30, right? Also, you know,
it's pretty good, Lionel Messi.
Yeah. Speaking of Dembele, you're saying, you know, it's not like for like exactly, because Neymar is just a supreme talent, arguably the best player on the planet. But Barcelona did pay less for Dembele than they got for Neymar, obviously. Mm-hmm. The price tag comes out to somewhere between $120-$160 million dollars US, depending on add ons. It's 105 euros to 145 euros, I believe. So, do you think that this is enough, or do you think that Barcelona needs to still go out and get Coutinho or get somebody else that can really bolster them?
I don't know. I don't know if they really do. You know, they've played two games and they've won them both. Maybe not in vintage Barcelona style, but they certainly have won without too much trouble. I think Dembele is not a like-for-like for Neymar. I don't know if you can name a player who's a like-for-like for Neymar. But I think he's a much better signing than Coutinho. I think he was a real exciting talent at Dortmund. He's 20 years old, as Joey says. He's a few years off his peak. Coutinho's 25. We kind of know what he is. You know, he pops up with these moments, and he does change games. But I don't know. If you're going to pay this kind of stupid money, which, let's face it, it's stupid money.
It's pretty stupid.
It's twice as much as this kid is worth. But it's to me, it's stupid money better spent than Coutinho would have been. You know, maybe you want to add Coutinho, because Barcelona have had a problem with depth for a long time now. Since they got rid of Pedro, mm-hmm. they've had really not many people to go to the bench when you need a goal or something. You know, if Suarez gets suspended or someone gets injured. So, you know, obviously they've got the money. We know they've got the money. So I guess you could still sign him. But I don't think they have any kind of dire need to. I think Dembele is, you know, probably going to try to work out pretty well for Barca.
Okay, well, let's
Can I say something real quick about Real Madrid, too?
Yeah.
It's so nice of them to pretend they're human and on the level of the rest of the world. I just think it's really charitable on their part, and we need to recognize that in this dark climate that we have these days, politically, socially. I think it's really cool that Real Madrid is not trying yet and letting everybody else kind of, you know, get some confidence. Good for them.
I'm a little baffled by that comment because they – I mean, Sergio Ramos was suspended – Ronaldo's obviously suspended. Asensio at 21 looks like the freaking best player on the planet all of a sudden. I'm not exactly buying that they're being charitable right now. I think they're laying the groundwork to remind you of how good and deep that they're going to be halfway through the season.
I just think they could have beaten Valencia by, like, you know, 4 or 5, and they said, "Nah, we'll give you a point out of this."
Half that match, Casemiro. No, they could not have beaten Valencia by 4 or 5. Valencia, I thought it was a pretty darn even match. Valencia could have scored a couple more. Real Madrid definitely could have scored a couple more. If, you know, Valencia doesn't have Simone Zaza, I think that, you know, that's a whole different scoreline.
Well, this team does draw, though. Let's not forget that when they had that, was it 40 games without losing, they drew quite a few of those. Yeah, yeah. So,
but this was a fight-back draw. They could have very easily lost this. And, you know, credit to Asensio. I don't think it was necessarily the greatest free kick, but he placed it. He put it on target, and that's all you can really ask for late in the match. A quick final shout out for La Liga. Aris Aduriz, who is one of my favorite players at Athletic Bilbao, he scored a header, which was set up by Iñaki Williams, who is a wonderful player if you ever get a chance to watch him. Probably one of the fastest players on the planet. But that goal actually meant that Aduriz has scored in 13 straight La Liga seasons. Mm-hmm. The only other player to do that? Lionel Messi.
And he's, if I'm not mistaken, he's top 20 now, I believe, in all-time La Liga goals.
He's also 36 and somehow still scoring goals in La Liga. But we're gonna, you know, we're gonna jump out of Spain and talk to the country that's been closely associated with Spain lately, France, PSG in particular. Seems like Kylian Mbappe and also Fabinho, it seems like, are both being reportedly going to PSG. And Monaco is the only other side that is actually perfect in Spain, I believe. They had a 6-1 thrashing of Marseille this weekend. And, I'm not sure exactly what to make of it because, you know, there's even, I believe, I saw a report saying that Lamar is being heavily targeted by Liverpool as well. Mm-hmm. So seemingly everybody in that squad's gone. And so far they've come out and they've won and they keep on winning. So credit to them. Do you guys have any comments on the ongoing saga that has been Kylian Mbappe's move away from Monaco, or have we just killed?
Just please, God, get it over with.
I know. I think he's pretty gone. And the reason that you kind of want it to be completed is, man, you talk about adding him to PSG. That's like literally like Champions League title favorite changing stuff, in my opinion. But that's another conversation for if it actually happens.
Yeah, well, we'll have plenty of time this year to get back to that. I will quickly touch in on everybody's favorite Serie A, and I will keep it super short just to say that Inter and Roma had probably the biggest match of the season. It was a really exciting game. Roma went up early, and then Mauro Icardi had a couple goals. And really, Inter came back, and it was a pretty wide-open game, but it was the Luciano Spalletti derby, if you will. He led Roma to second place last year and just really never got appreciated. Moved over to Inter, and the second he did that, I actually think that was the biggest transfer in Serie A last summer. Right now, you look at the top of the table, and it's great. You know, you have Juventus perfect, you have Inter perfect, you have AC Milan perfect, you have Napoli perfect, and Sampdoria is the fifth team. You expect them to drop off a little bit, but it's good to see the traditional powerhouses, the two Milan clubs in particular, back up there and looking like they're going to be competing with Juve, because that's what makes that league great. Plus, we've talked about it. Serie A has 4 Champions League spots next year, so you'd like to see those big clubs finish in Europe and then be able to use that extra revenue and build and stay relevant and not fall away, which is what's happened in the last few years. One quick final point about Belotti. Actually, I'll make 2 points. One, Napoli has just it looks great with Insigne and with Mertens. They're just, it's a new look Napoli. The memory of that Cavani, Hamsik, Lavezzi, Mazzarri Napoli is just completely erased now. and you're seeing this, you know, Mertens and Insigne, and it's fun. It's a really fun team when you watch them play. And the second point I want to make is Andrea Belotti's insanely incredible goal, probably the best goal of this weekend and probably this season. If you haven't seen it, you should look it up. It's just an off balance. He jumps up about 4 or 5 feet in the air, bicycle kick, you could say, but it is one of the most acrobatic goals, and he's, you know, doing it under pressure, under duress. It's is worth looking up. And this kid is really, really good, which we will probably get to a little bit in the international talk. Any comments you guys have for the rest of Europe, what you guys have seen that stood out, or should we just move on?
I could say there's some controversy about that Roma-Inter game, because I'm going to surprise you and say I actually did watch it. And I think that...
Was MLS on break?
I think I was blacked out from local coverage. I don't even know, but it was on sort of late in the afternoon. But there was, I think, a clear penalty denied Roma, and then they reviewed it with VAR, or there's some kind of controversy about the VAR did not award the penalty when it was pretty clear that it should have been a penalty. Had that been a penalty, Roma would have gone up 2.
Well,
what
I'll say about it is that Serie A is the forward-thinking league in Europe right now that is actually using VAR. And, you know, they're going to be a fair amount of kinks, but more often than not, I saw a good quote from, I'm forgetting the name of the referee, or Rizzoli, who everybody knows. He's the most famous Italian referee. And he said, you know, yes, it's not perfect, but what he sees as a positive is that when these decisions are being handed out, the players and the managers aren't arguing. They're accepting them. And that's a great sign when you're a referee and a decision is being awarded or being stated. As much as the players may not agree with the process it's going through, they understand it's the right decision. And ultimately, that's the reason we have VAR in the sport, or we're trying to get it into the sport. And I mean, I don't think it's, you know, going away. We're going to see it in the World Cup. We're going to see it, you know, it probably beyond.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm okay with testing it out and seeing how it works. And thank you to Serie A for taking on that burden.
All right, you just saved the VAR segment I brought up. Cool.
Okay, well, we're going to take a break on that note, and then we're going to come back and talk USMNT, International World Cup Qualifying. All right, we'll be right back. This podcast is brought to you by Solar Eclipses, because they're better than lunar eclipses. All right, we are back, and now we're going to get into the U.S. men's national team. We know you guys have been waiting for this segment. So the USA takes on Costa Rica at Red Bull Arena in New Jersey on Friday, September the 1st. Costa Rica is actually a point ahead of the United States in qualifying, with Mexico leading the way on 14 points. Now, USA is currently on 8 points and is only 1 point ahead of Panama for that final guaranteed spot for the 2018 World Cup, and 3 points ahead of Honduras. So if the U.S. loses or only gets a draw against Costa Rica, Panama could theoretically jump the USA with a win at Azteca Stadium. That's not a likely result, but it is possible. Otherwise, a USA loss and a Honduras win away to Trinidad and Tobago could see Honduras level with the U.S. on points. That, of course, would be a big result, because the U.S. goes on to play Honduras on September 5th during the same international break. And even though USA beat Honduras 6-0 in San Jose in March, when Clint Dempsey had the hat-trick and Christian Pulisic scored his first goal of World Cup qualifying, that would be a massive game. After this round of games, USA has 2 more qualifiers in October against Panama in Orlando on October 6th and away to Trinidad and Tobago on October 10th. So I will ask you guys, will the U.S. men's national team qualify for the 2018 World Cup? And probably more importantly, what are you guys looking to see from the squad in these qualifiers between now and, well, October?
Well, I think the squad will surely qualify for the World Cup. As a matter of fact, I think there's a 1% chance that it could actually be sealed based on results over the next few days. I don't know the math, so I don't want to get into it. But, I mean, you know, the U.S. is in, like, a pretty good position. Third, as you said, in the hex. But I always think, and you know, people say that this is that CONCACAF is a very forgiving region, and I do agree with that. But you can't necessarily let that guide your approach to things, because I'll say this: Honduras's first match in this international break is away to Trinidad and Tobago, who's currently last, and I think is pretty much the only team that's not going to go, has no shot of going to the World Cup out of this group. So who knows if Honduras gets a result there, if the U.S., who plays the second toughest team in the region at home, doesn't get more than, you know, a draw or maybe even loses that game, then all of a sudden you've got an away match to Honduras next Tuesday that could be a lot trickier given the team's away form. I know that the U.S. just had the draw at Azteca, and that was fantastic, but it's not been a great qualifying campaign in the Caribbean and Central America for the United States outside of that. So you really got to take this Costa Rica match is everything. You got to get the win here, because that will go a really long way towards sealing the team's ticket to I almost said Brazil. I'm flashing back to 4 years ago. Seal the team's ticket to Russia.
Yeah, it was just one quick point I'll make out. First of all, it's TNT, so it's dynamite. second of all, more importantly, Costa Rica did whoop the U.S. 4-0.
Complete destruction.
And that was kind of the turning point, and that's what brought in Bruce Arena. I will ask you, Alex. So based on what you saw with the Gold Cup and the squad that the United States had, which was kind of a weakened squad, but it also had a ton of veterans, and it was kind of a weird mix. With all the talent that came out, you know, the Darlington Nagbys and Clint Dempsey still showing he's got it, Jozy Altidore coming, having a renaissance, or I don't know what you'd call it because he's not really an old man. And then you have Christian Pulisic available now, and you know, Bobby Wood should be available as well. How would you line up the United States, assuming that they do qualify? What do you think is their best attacking combination? And do you think any of those guys that I just mentioned aren't going to make it to the squad?
For the World Cup?
Yeah.
It's certainly possible that we'll see some turnover. I think that, as an LA Galaxy fan, I could say omitting Jermaine Jones from the squad was a good move, because I think that it's time to figure out who the guy who's going to stand next to Michael Bradley in midfield is, because I don't think it's going to be Jermaine Jones in 2018. It certainly shouldn't be, in my opinion.
Who's stronger, Arsenal's center holding midfielder or Jermaine Jones?
He might be being scouted by Wenger right now as a potential solution. I think that goalkeeper-wise, maybe we got to start looking for Ethan Horvath over in the Belgian league is doing really well. He's a guy I'd maybe like to see brought more into the fold before 2018 World Cup, provided we make it, which I tend to agree with Joey that we probably will. Jozy Altidore, people criticize him a lot, but he does manage to score goals for club, and he's, as we saw in the last World Cup, when he got injured, the U.S. really had no attacking focal point. So I think he's pretty much safe in the squad. Maybe Wondolowski's a guy we might not see too much further down the line.
Yeah.
Clint Dempsey, I think, is still going to be at least an off-the-bench player, if not a guaranteed starter. But I sort of like the squad. I mean, it's got 18 players that were in the Gold Cup, which I think was a very therapeutic thing for the U.S. national team to go and win the Gold Cup and sort of get its mojo back. So, we've got a good squad that can do the business, but it does look sort of forward to the future. The guys I'm missing, maybe apart from Horvath, I would have liked to have maybe seen Timothy Chandler included in the squad. And I don't know, not too many other people, not too many other omissions.
Yeah, I think the good thing that the Gold Cup did was look at the inclusions that they have. Christian Roldan and Paul Areola and some of the other guys that got a lot of burn at that tournament. And it wasn't because you were necessarily saying, oh, these guys are going to be, the future going forward, or these guys are going to supplant some of the more experienced players that play those positions. But they developed versatility, they got experience, and you can bring them in here in a pinch in case something goes wrong, someone gets injured. And I just look up and down the squad, and I think it kind of defines itself based on, and this is something we always had a problem with Klinsmann, he would call in, a lot of different players and kind of mess around with a lot of different formations, and it would never really settle itself around tournaments necessarily. There would still be kind of that tinkering, that experimentation, even in the World Cup, frankly. And you look at this roster, Howard is probably a safe bet to start in goal. The injuries that are in the back line with DeAndre Yedlin and John Brooks both missing, at least you could say there are quick fixes to that. You know, Cameron's probably going to be a center half, and Omar Gonzalez will probably be the other first-choice center half. Outside, Fabian Johnson's technically listed as a midfielder, but he's got a lot of experience at outside back. And then you've also got Graham Zusi out there. You know, this just there's good options. And then in the attack, to kind of go back to the original point, Clint Dempsey, I would say, is probably going to be more super sub than starter. You're probably going to see Altidore, Wood, and Morris, some combination of one or two of them starting in these matches. And then in the midfield, I think, you know, a lot of people are waiting for either Kellen Acosta or Darlington Nagbe to kind of be that midfielder that thinks forward as Michael Bradley sort of, again, develops into that guy who drops a bit deeper back, more of a number six. So I just, you know, again, I look at this, and Pulisic fits anywhere. He's fantastic.
I was just going to ask, does he even make the squad?
Where do you play? If you're in the charge, do you play him wide or do you play him central?
I think that I want to play him centrally, ideally, but I'm just not sure that's the best spot for him right now. We could be talking about this differently after the World Cup next summer, maybe even entering it. I think he's most effective right now kind of where he plays for Borussia Dortmund, and he's definitely acquitted himself well there. So I would say that you keep him on the wing, and you've got no shortage of guys who can play. You know, Jozy Altidore can be a hold-up man in that kind of formation. Bobby Wood can also play a little bit more wide. Like, even if you bring Clint Dempsey on, he plays on the wing, I think, a lot for Seattle Sounders as it is. So, again, there's when you look at the roster, just the names – everything kind of clicks into place, and I think that's what the national program was looking for when Jurgen Klinsmann was let go and Bruce Arena was brought back, just some kind of semblance of consistency.
Are you guys more excited about 2018 than you were 2014?
It's hard to say. I would say no, because I thought Klinsmann was, despite, you know, I wasn't saying that we had some big results in international friendlies, and there was definitely kind of a shaking up of the status quo, and bringing over some of those German-born American players was definitely paying off. You know, a lot of them have helped the team greatly and contributed to success. And I just thought that was like the test. You're going to be like, okay, is this United States team really the step forward that Klinsmann promised and that the program went out and looked for? And I think that we could do well at the World Cup next summer. Don't get me wrong, but in terms of sheer excitement, I got to say 2014 was more for me.
I'm not there yet. I'm not quite into the World Cup excitement zone.
I don't mean get excited by the World Cup. I mean excited about the squad compared to the squad that went to the World Cup. Are you more when you look at these names?
Right. Do you miss Julian Green? Might be a good way to put it.
I think
man for man, I might be more excited about this team. But like Joey, around that time, I had definitely drank my share of Klinsmann Kool-Aid. So I was pretty excited to see, you know, how we were going to start playing like this magical Barcelona team or something. But that didn't happen. It was still pretty good. But yeah, when I look at the squad that we could put out in Russia, I think it's maybe a little bit more exciting than the 2014 squad was.
You know who had not drank the Klinsmann Kool-Aid? Landon Donovan.
Not at all.
He wasn't awful.
The opposite. He probably bought it. He bought a six-pack and smashed the bottles outside.
He was denied. They wouldn't give him any.
So any other points you guys want to make about the men's national team, or should I move on to the other qualifiers that are going on in the next week or so?
Yeah, move on.
All right. Well, you know, let's start with South America. Argentina or Uruguay, August 31st, is a massive, massive match. Messi's no longer suspended. Icardi, as we said earlier, is in the Argentina squad, coming off of 4 goals in 2 matches. And right now, Argentina is actually in that 5th spot, which means they're due to go up against Oceania in a playoff. We would think they would make it through, but still, it's neck and neck in South America. Also, September 5th, Brazil in Colombia. Now, Brazil's already qualified, but it's a big match for Colombia. Also, Chile at the high altitude of La Paz, also on September 5th. Those two matches are massive because Argentina only trails Chile and Uruguay by 1 point and Colombia by 2 points. So really, it's 2 through 5 are neck and neck, and there should be significant movement coming up. Brazil, as a reminder, is the only team that's already qualified. Going over to UEFA, over to Europe, France is hosting the Netherlands on August 31st, and right now Sweden is winning Group A, so France actually would be in line for a second-round playoff. Now, I'll briefly explain how UEFA works because it's a little bit more complicated than most. They have 9 group winners, so there's 9 groups, and the top team at the end of qualifying or this stage of qualifying automatically gets through, so that's 9 of them. And then you have 8 runner-up spots, so one of the second-place finishers in those groups actually gets knocked out ahead of time, And then those eight teams play two-leg playoff, and that's going to be in November, I believe. And then the winner of those playoffs goes through. So right now we have, you know, France is not in that spot. There are a lot of teams, notable teams, that are not in those automatic qualifications and looking for playoffs. And I'll include some pretty big Euro 2016 names. France, Italy, Iceland, and Portugal, all in those runner-up spots going into this round of games. Now, Spain and Italy are actually level on points in Group G. Portugal trails Switzerland in Group B, and France and Sweden are level on points at the top of Group A, with Netherlands only 3 points back in Group A as well. So if you're going to watch one match in World Cup qualifying, watch Spain versus Italy on September the 2nd. Those two teams are tied at the top of Group G. Only one gets the automatic qualification spot, which seems crazy when you think it's Spain and Italy. They're going to actually, one of those two teams is going to have to go through a playoff. Asensio will, I think he's in the squad, I'm almost positive. And the match is at the Bernabeu, so keep an eye out for that guy stepping up. On the other side, I was talking about Belotti earlier. Insigne will probably be in the squad as well from Napoli, but Belotti is the guy that he's 23 and he seems to be the future of Italy. Everybody's super excited about him. He sold Torino, but they basically just don't want to sell him, and somebody will pay his, I think his buyout clause is only a little bit over 100 million. So somebody will come for him at some point, and pretty soon, I would imagine, because he's been really good the last couple of years, and everyone kind of knows he's the future of the Italy squad. For me, he's the best Italian striker on the planet. But that is, you know, I'm not going to get into Africa and Asia. Sorry to disrespect any of you guys. But, you know, for the three major confederations that appeal to us or appeal to me directly, that's kind of where we're at. And really, it's just these couple match days coming up for, you know, World Cup qualifying. And then we have those in October. And that's going to be the bulk of the field aside from these extra playoffs that UEFA has. But CONCACAF is going to be going up against the Asia qualifier as well. So we're really going down to the wire. It's going to be decided between this international break and the next international break on who is really going to be a 2018 World Cup. So yeah, again, if you're going to watch one match, Spain versus Italy for UEFA, I think that, you know, it's at the Santiago Bernabeu in Madrid in the capital. And I think it's going to be a highly intensive 90-minute match. What any comments, guys?
Yeah, I think just it kind of underscores how brutal it can be to get out of Europe. And I do think that, I mean, you just look at the way that the groups were drawn. You know, there's certain teams like England and Poland kind of have buys almost to get to the World Cup based on the groups that they're in. Meanwhile, you know, like you said, France and Sweden and the Netherlands all in the same group. Spain and Italy all in the same group. Group D has got Wales, Austria, Ireland, and Serbia, who's actually leading the group. So, and while it's not necessarily a death sentence to have one of these playoff rounds, you might draw like a Northern Ireland. On the other hand, like you said, you might draw a Portugal. And you just go to South America real quick. I think that, you know, the five teams that I think everyone pretty much expects to qualify are in the qualifying positions. But don't sleep, you know, just because Peru, I think, has been third place at the last two Copa Americas. Ecuador, a fantastic home side. They don't lose at home very often. So these matches still matter, and you could find one of these teams right behind the Argentinas, the Uruguays, the Colombias, rise up and take one of those spots in the World Cup. So there's a lot to be decided. It's going to be an exciting week, I think.
Yeah, Paraguay, Peru are only 2 points back of Ecuador. So they're on 18 points. Ecuador's on 20 in sixth place. And Argentina is only on 22. Now, number two spot, Colombia, is only on 24. So you're talking about a six-point difference between the team that's in eighth place and the team that's in second place. So it's South America, there's going to be a fair amount of movement, you would imagine. Argentina, I think, will probably end up going up higher, but when you look at the teams above it, you're talking about Chile, Uruguay, Colombia, and Brazil is the only team that's through. So it's, you know, South America is the most brutal World Cup qualifying, and they play more matches than anybody else, and they seem like they're rougher than everybody else in those qualifiers too. So it's definitely, you know, I would highly I would suggest that you keep an eye on that Argentina at Uruguay match on the 31st.
Hey, as resident MLS apologist on the pod, I just want to offer congratulations to David Villa of NYCFC for getting a call up to Spain for the first time in 3 years, and meanwhile, Sebastian Giovinco is still waiting by the phone for a call from Italy. I don't know what's
going on. Does he have, like, incriminating, like, evidence against, like, the... Well, I guess you could say that the Italian Football Federation has incriminating evidence on him, right? Like, there's just no reason for him to be left out of the squad.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. It's two coaches now, Conti and Ventura, who've ignored Giovinco, who's been in hot form for the past three seasons.
He can't. Well, when Toronto runs away with MLS Cup here in a couple months, that'll be his that'll be his saving grace.
Well, I think more the idea is that if he has been so good, and he has been really good here, is that why hasn't he made the move back to Europe?
I think he likes it in Toronto, and there was, you know, sort of a little interest, he called it, from Barcelona a couple of seasons ago. But, you know, I think he likes playing in Toronto and winning. Well,
what I'm saying is from, you know, I'm just playing devil's advocate here, but I think from the Italian Federation or the manager's perspective, you say, okay, well, Barcelona was potentially coming for you. Well, you probably could have gone to a team that's not Barcelona, you know, half a step down, and then proven yourself. If you really wanted to be in the Italy squad, if you'd rather just focus on your club career, which is what he's doing, and he's doing a great job of it, then more power to you. But it seems like they're not really interested in using their scouting on MLS, clearly, because he's been really good since he's been here. I don't think anyone would say he's been a disappointment. It's just a matter of he's not old, and if he's been that good, how come he hasn't tried to make a move back to what, you know, everybody would consider the height of the sport, is the European clubs?
It could be money. He's probably not going to get paid as much money going to, you know.
I find that hard.
What club can he walk into? He's not going to walk back into Juve. Maybe one of the Milan clubs who are rebuilding, he could have gone back into one of those.
He can always say, like, he can always play the card, like, I'm being treated unfairly. If he goes back to Europe and fails, well, then there's no more. Yeah, it's kind of a comfortable position to be in, if you
suppose.
Yeah, well, I mean, to say that he wouldn't get paid as much is, I think, silly, because you always get paid more to play in Europe. There's more money over there than there is over here for players. So I'm sure he's getting paid pretty well, but over there, if he was to go to even a middle-tier club and be essentially their bigger signing or one of their best players, I mean, he's a former national teamer. You know, he's went from Juve. His pedigree suggests that he would get paid more in Europe than he would here. So I think I understand why he's not getting a look. I'm not saying I agree with it, but I understand. All that said, I think that will wrap it all up. For Joey Galino, for Alex Baker, this is Shahan Ahmed. Thanks for listening. And as always, I will remind you, please look us up on Facebook. We are at facebook.com/FCYahoo, all one word. And also download these podcasts on SoundCloud, Audioboom, and wherever you find your podcast, Apple Music, iTunes, we're there as well. Also on Twitter, you can follow us at FC Yahoo. Thanks for listening once again, and hopefully we will be back next week.
Throw it out, my boys. RB Leipzig, 4 goals in the second half.